This is the Food Afield podcast, a show about wild food ingredients and how to collect them. And now, broadcasting from the wilds of Alberta, is your host, John David Schneider.
Everybody to the Food Afield podcast. I'm here today with a new friend of mine, Eric Leslie. Did I pronounce the last name right?
Correctly.
Leslie. Yep. And so we're just going to get to know Eric because Eric, we've, as I mentioned, we're new friends. You were very kind to me on Twitter, which I've just recently rejoined. And that's what got me to just look into who Eric was a little bit. And man, I went down a bit of a rabbit hole. You are a very interesting fellow with all of the things that you're doing. So I wanted to talk with you a bit about that today, get to know you a little bit better. Welcome to the show.
Awesome, John. Thank you for having me. I'm truly honored. I've never done anything like this. So.
Oh, really? Oh, that surprises me. You're crushing it with some content with regards to fly fishing. And so I guess we'll start off. I want to get to know Eric a little bit. You are in NorCal, but that's all I know. Do you mind sharing whereabouts you live?
And sure. I know when people hear the word Northern California, they tend to think Bay Area, maybe Sacramento, Tahoe, but drive 2 hours north, that's the real Northern California. That up here, a lot of us joke around, we'll say a Sacramento Bay Area, we call that Southern California. We're kind of the forgotten part of the state. So I'm way up north, up in the Cascades, close to Mount Shasta. So that's just what I get to call home.
It's just gorgeous up there. I'm watching your YouTube videos, and you are an excellent videographer and editor, but you can't fake the scenery, and some of the places that you are fishing is just, it's phenomenal. I thought Alberta was beautiful for fishing, but yeah, that's crazy. So tell me a little bit about, about you, let's just start with the fly fishing, I guess. I had this all organized in my head ahead of time, and now it's all jumbled up. What got you started in fly fishing?
Well, I don't have one of those stories where my pa brought me up fishing as a kid. I grew up on a coastal town surfing and went to college up near where I live now. And when I was done, I loved the mountains. So all kinds of things have sort of taken me up into the mountains before fly fishing. It was photography. That's what got me started with that side of my creativity was photos. And then that turned into video. And that's my professional background was doing portraits and weddings mostly until COVID came around because weddings kind of got shut down for that year in 2020. So I pivoted and it was actually my wife that got me into fly fishing. She picked it up first. She told me she had interest in fly fishing and I bought her a rod for Christmas and she picked it up. And about 6 months later, I got one of my own and the rest is history. So I'm a fairly new fly fisherman. I've been doing it about 3 years now. But I love it so much. It's just totally consumed me.
I love that. I am running into so many people that are adult onset hunters or adult onset fishers. And I just find that so cool because in a time where you think that maybe anti-hunting and anti-fishing might be gaining traction, I'm just finding the opposite, where people are just starting to come to terms with their natural surroundings and interacting with it in ways that that I can get on board with, right? And I mean, 100%. You know, the spin on what I do, I want to talk to you a little bit about that, but the spin on what I do is basically wild food ingredients and then how to acquire them, right? Two focuses so I can kind of cross over and talk to people. I find that fly fishing, it's difficult to have that wild food discussion because with fly fishermen, it's just catch and release seems to be the mantra. And I understand why. In the States especially, but maybe just talk to me a little bit about that in Northern California. Are the waters there, do you have any keep limits and do you ever participate in any keep limits at all?
It's going to vary river to river. I would say in general, a lot of the rivers you can have limits where you can take fish and keep them if you want. There are a few designated catch and release only, or a section of a river is catch and release only. But you're right, it's definitely a cultural thing. I think it up here it's more acceptable to harvest fish out of lakes or places where the fish are stocked in rivers. It's generally frowned upon to take wild fish, even if it's legally allowed to. And I would say I'm primarily catch and release, mainly because I wouldn't, you know, I don't have, it's more of a logistics thing. Like, I'm on the river all day. If I catch a fish in the beginning of the day, I don't know what to do with it while I'm out hiking out. Because I'm usually, you know, traveling on foot miles from the parking areas to get to these places just because I love the adventure side of it. But usually when I do cape fish, it's from a lake. Just, I don't know. It's just easier, I think, for me to rationalize a limited resource when it's coming out of a lake, usually stocked fish.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, stocked for sure. I mean, it sounds like a similar situation that we have here in Alberta. You know, but I guess, well, I'd be interested to learn, you know, what kind of fishing pressure you guys have down in your neck of the woods. I mean, are you running into guys when you're out fishing some of these streams?
Again, that's going to vary. And since I tend to like going on adventures on foot and hiking back, I don't usually run into other anglers. That said, I think a lot of the tributaries around Mount Shasta, north of the Sacramento area, see a lot less pressure. A lot of the Bay Area folks, they go to Tahoe, so like the Truckee River you've probably heard of. I mean, that's a very popular river, and there's probably sees thousands of anglers. In fact, the first time I visited, there's a smaller one near called the Little Truckee. And I'm used to, if I see a fly fisherman, I'll just hike until I don't see anyone again. And I consider that a busy day on the water if I see one or two other people, God forbid. But there I saw 30 other people fishing. And this is a fairly small river where you can fish, maybe 2 or 3 miles of water. And I saw so many people, it was very shocking to me. Mm. And I guess that's just a matter of proximity to populations, because you know, Sacramento and Bay Area has got millions of people, and that's the closest place to go. But further north, if you're willing to travel 2, 3 hours, 4 hours away from that, there's very little pressure, at least from what I've seen. And I know there's a lot of people that, you know, would still say there's still too much pressure, because I know the COVID's brought a lot of people into the mountains and into fishing and maybe hunting. I'm not as familiar with that world, but from my point of view, there's not much pressure the further away from the cities you get.
Yeah. It was, again, sounds very similar, which I find surprising, because what's the population of Alberta? I think we're up near 4 million total in the entire province. And I don't know, square kilometers or square mileage. I'm guessing that Alberta is bigger than California. That might just be so completely obvious to everybody, but
geographically, like,
yeah,
probably. Yeah. I assume most of that population's in Calgary.
No, it's split between Calgary and Edmonton pretty evenly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know that.
But definitely an urban, you know, the rural parts of Alberta, and especially the northern half of Alberta, are, you know, just wide open crown land, you know, gosh, yeah, there's land that you could never explore in a daytime or in a lifetime. But similar, when I get fishing down in southern Alberta, some of the more popular streams, of course, we will run into the odd person, but it still seems pretty easy to just get on the boots and get away from people completely. So I'm actually surprised to hear you say that, considering California has roughly the same population as our entire country. So it's, you know,
if you go to the Sierras, I mean, that's a beautiful part of the state, and there's going to be more people there. I mean, that's, you just got to maybe do a little more research, spend more time looking for blue lines on maps, and be willing to strike out. Cause you know what, when I go exploring, you don't necessarily know what you're going to find. If it's, you know, not a major river that, you know, it's just a tributary of a major river, you never know. And sometimes those days are not productive, or, you know, it's just part of the game, I think, part of the fun.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. I handle the catch and release thing a little differently than you. We have, with the exception of, we have very few native wild populations of trout. We have cutthroat trout, and we have native rainbows. But most of the native rainbows have been eradicated by crossbreeding with the introduced cutthroats. And we've also had, like, the Bow River has been stocked with rainbows, browns, and those rainbows actually came from coastal waters of the Pacific Northwest. So they're actually steelhead. Okay. So it's actually, it's kind of interesting. But when I go out fishing, I will generally target, you know, for instance, the Rocky Mountain whitefish. Do you guys have those down there? Rocky Mountain whites?
Not in my waters, but they are, like in the Truckee has them. They're more in the high altitude rivers.
Mm. Yeah, so I'll target those quite often. And then, you know, I look at it a little differently where I don't have a problem keeping a fish. But, you know, we're talking about like one fish a year, right? Where I want to have a really nice campfire meal. And, you know, it's funny because when I asked you that question, you started shifting in your chair a little bit. It's a weird conversation to have with fly fishermen.
I'm not anti-keeping fish, not at all. And it's one of those things where, well, when I hear people, you know, they show me their picture of a stringer catching a limit, and I'm thinking, if I catch a fish and I want to eat it, I want to get enough for one meal because I don't like fish that's been on ice. It doesn't taste as good to me. So I like fresh fish. So if I want to catch a fish, I might keep one or two for that meal, but I'm not going to catch a limit most likely because I just want to have fresh fish. So
yeah, no, I'm the same way. I agree. If it's freshly bonked and over the campfire right there on the stream, then that's one thing, but I'm not bringing home fish for the freezer.
And again, I don't judge people. It's hard to quantify the impact of keeping fish on a fishery. I mean, a lot of people have a lot of anecdotal opinions, I think. And I think it's hard to, I mean, somebody maybe that's been fishing 30 years, that might be some of my naivete since I've only been doing it 3 or 4 years, is I haven't seen this big window of what the rivers are like. But I think there's often a tendency of people to, you know, think highly of the past, you know, like, it's like this golden memory.
I know,
time's lost. So
it makes me cringe when I see those pictures. We get them up here in Alberta all the time because we, of course, have the national parks, the Banff National Park in Jasper. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they tend to like to show is pictures from the 20s, you know, with these guys that have caught, you know, just like the bow is between two pine trees and it's just sagging under the weight of these trout, right? And it just breaks my heart. But anyways, I'm glad we're beyond that. Well, let's get away from that a little bit. I want to talk a bit about your business because I find that really interesting. Now, you said you pivoted away from an industry 2 or 3 years ago, which was a photography industry, correct? Is that what you
said? Correct, mm-hmm. Right. So I have very few clients anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, but you still dabble in it. See, I'm learning.
A couple.
Yeah. I'm just kind of getting started on my photographic journey and I'm really enjoying it with an old Canon 7D that I use. And
great camera.
I love it. Yeah, I love it. But now your business is interesting. So when did you start Driftstone?
So that's all very new also. I launched that about 2 or 3 months ago now. So
oh, really? That's it?
It's very fresh, very new. Yes.
Oh, Eric. Oh, that I never would have guessed that. So that's interesting because you just seem like an absolute going concern, and you are.
Well, the YouTube's been going a couple years. I went probably really serious about a year ago, thinking I wanted to be a YouTuber. And then that developed into Driftstone, where I have a fly shop where I'm selling flies and fly tying materials for now.
Mm-hmm. I love the design. Your aesthetic on everything that you do is amazing. Your videography. I haven't really seen your photography. Where can people go to really get a good glimpse of some of your photographs?
Well, I mean, if you go to my Instagram and you go back in time, you'll see a lot of my client work. It's a lot of weddings. It's totally out of character for what my current feed shows. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's out there. I don't really advertise it or post it much. So, I mean, if you go back really far, find my Flickr page, if you remember that or know what that is.
Well, no, I'm talking about the fly fishing, though. Like, where do I, like, are you doing much photography or are you kind of sticking mainly to
mainly video. I mean, if I'm doing photos, it's going to be for thinking of, like, creating a thumbnail for a video or I don't know, if you just happen to be out when the sunset's blowing up, I'll turn the camera towards it and take a picture. Mm-hmm. But that's not my primary focus. It's mainly video content for now, yeah.
Yeah. And again, folks, if you get on YouTube and just search up Eric Leslie, on YouTube. That's your channel name, correct?
Yep.
You'll run into, I don't know how many videos you have. I haven't gotten through them all.
Quite a few. It's about 75, yeah. I think.
Yeah. And they're all sort of cinematic. They tell stories, not narratively, but just with the pictures. And it's just a wonderful channel. Gosh, I'm not afraid to admit that I've wasted quite a bit of time. Not wasted, but I've spent quite a bit of time on my phone watching your YouTube channel.
Well, that's awesome.
Now, tell me a bit about your shop now. You mentioned like a lot of your content because you also invited me to your Discord. And I'm such a newbie with that. I don't even know what a Discord is, but I'm kind of getting the hang of it. So I'll let you talk about that. What is your Discord and how do folks find that? Please visit foodafieldpodcast.com for additional content, including articles and photography. Also, when you're there, don't forget to sign up for the newsletter, which always contains exclusive offers or free behind-the-scenes audio segments that are not available anywhere else. Thanks.
Well, Discord is basically like a community where you can chat about whatever your subject is. It's an app that kind of came out of the gaming world and YouTubers have sort of adopted it and it's kind of grown broader into other subjects like fly fishing. And it's just it's a community that I've created around the channel that people can go and discuss fly fishing or fly tying, ask questions about tactics, all kinds of stuff. And that's also fairly new. So that's a growing group of people that are right now mostly local to Northern California, which is great because you can get fishing reports and I don't know, just intel on what bugs are hatching where, and that's super valuable information. And if you'd like to join, probably the easiest way is to find one of my videos, and there's an invite link on the descriptions. It's kind of a URL that's hard to tell verbally. It's like a code. So yeah, go look for that in the video descriptions, and you can join and get involved. Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Your Instagram handle. I haven't spent a lot of time.
That's my name also, at Eric Leslie. And
okay.
That I try to be a little less formal. I know some people like to have, you know, just their pretty pictures, but I like sharing more behind the scenes. Like recently I showed a photo of my camera because I was taking photos of a fly that I'm adding to the shop. A macro
I love that shot.
And I had what I see, you know, outside the camera and what the camera sees, it's pretty interesting, I think, to see how much more detail the camera can see versus our naked eye.
Yeah. I love that shot. I know exactly the one you're talking about. Okay, so now let's get onto your website, which is, I guess, a business that you are just starting to hustle now. Mm-hmm. You seem to focus a lot of your attention on tying flies. So maybe that must be a new thing for you as well. But I don't know how it could be because your flies are amazing.
Well, I started tying flies, fairly early in my fly fishing career. Mainly because somebody took me out when I was still learning and he gave me some waltz worms, something we talked about in the Discord as being our, if we were to choose one fly, we both agreed a waltz worm might be that fly. And he gave one to me. And as you know, eventually they get lost on snags or trees or something. And I ran out of them and my local fly shop didn't carry them. So I said, well, I guess I better learn how to tie these things. And that started it. And, you know, it's not really cheaper, at least starting out, because there's a lot of tools you've got to buy. I mean, you could look at the cost per fly, I guess, once you have everything and think it's cheaper, but it's really not. I probably spent way more on fly tying materials and supplies and tools.
You never have everything.
No. There's always another color or a new material to find.
Or a better vise or better hackle pliers or whatever.
Yep. Yeah. 100%. It's a rabbit hole that never ends.
Yeah, and it's a fun one though. It's I enjoy it. I don't tie enough. I don't tie. Well, let me put it this way: I tie enough. I tie for what I need, but you know, I wish I had to tie more. I need more friends that fly fish, I guess. So, how much of your time then is spent tying flies? Like the flies that you sell on your website, which is driftstone.co. How much of your time during your day do you spend tying flies then to cover that? Is it because it's so new, you know, you're comfortably staying ahead of it?
I'm comfortably staying ahead of it now. I mean, I am doing this full time, so I've got the time, but it surprised me. Like, you never, I mean, my channel's fairly modestly at this point. It's maybe 1,500 subscribers, and you never really know how many of those people are truly engaged in me or my content. And when I offered them for sale, it just instantly seems to hit the ground running. And so I'm very thankful for everybody who's bought flies and continue to. It's every time I post a video and, you know, I'm catching a lot of fish on some fly or that fly, there's always seems like a rush to pick it up. So after every video drops, there is a bit of work, but it tends to taper off between videos. But, you know, it's, I don't know, it's manageable at this point. I haven't thought about what's going to happen if things continue to grow. I mean, I've got room in the time bucket still.
Good. Well, yeah, I don't know. Piece of friendly advice to you would be to maybe start thinking ahead of your how you're going to keep up, because what I see, I don't see how this thing doesn't take off for you. You're doing such a great job.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I would like to sell more fly tying materials. That's kind of a it's kind of a tough thing because there's so many, and if somebody's looking for something specific and I don't have it, they might keep looking. So I mean, my selection of materials is pretty modest. It's just a few things right now. But as it grows, I'm going to continue expanding, and hopefully it can be, you know, a full menu of things to choose from.
Okay, let's talk about that a bit, because that's something that you want to focus on. Why do you choose, like, what are the hooks that you're always, that you're showing or that you're selling? You always have them on your...
The brand, they're fire hole hooks.
Right.
It's a higher end brand of hooks, I think. I mean, there's probably better hooks, but there's kind of this, when you're tying commercially, there's this balance you have to find between the cost versus quality, because, flies are expensive and so are the materials. So you kind of have to find that economic balance, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. And so that's a brand I've partnered with for my beads and hooks. And I've been happy with them so far. I haven't had any complaints about, you know, hooks bending out on big fish yet. But I've got a few other tying friends that have given me advice on how to get started and directions to go. So I appreciate them tremendously.
Mm-hmm. Who are they? We can mention them.
Well, the biggest one is my buddy Bob. He runs another YouTube channel called Trout Flies. He's based out of Utah. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of close to the fly fish food universe. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them. They're pretty big online influence in the fly tying community. And so... Yeah, I mean, he would probably be the biggest one. I'd give him a shout out for sure. Mm-hmm. He's helped me a lot.
Are you picking the materials that you sell for specific reasons? As in, are these materials that you're fishing yourself and you just decided you like them, or are they more opportunistic type?
It's a mix of both. I mean, I was tying on Firehole before I started to sell them, for sure. I mean, there's some interesting things in the industry that many people probably wouldn't know. Like, you've heard of Haroline or Wapsie or two major brands, but they won't sell to you unless you have a physical fly shop. So I probably will not be carrying the materials anytime soon. So, and I like the idea of picking companies that are maybe a little less known, a little more scrappy. So far I've got Firehole for hooks and beads, and then I've got Semperfly, which is a not small company by any means, but... At least in the thread world, it's a little smaller, lesser used, because like UTC is probably the most popular thread company. Everyone uses that, but it's a combination. It's mostly what I like to use, and combination of what's available to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go down this fly tying route a little bit here. So you explained why you started tying flies, and then that's led into this business. What is your favorite tie right now?
Favorite? Let's see. I would say for the satisfaction of tying, something called a shop vac. It's really simple. It's just a pheasant tail body with a wire rib, and it has this little like fibery wing emerging out of the back of it. Some reason, it's just really satisfying when the wraps of pheasant tail wrap around the hook perfectly.
Yeah.
It's just very clean, and I don't know. It's just very satisfying.
Is that a wet or a nymph?
It's a nymph. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I've never heard of it. Shotback. Okay.
It's basically a pheasant tail variant. It's called a shotback because it cleans up.
It's been very
effective for me too. It's a great fly.
Okay. Yeah. And I suppose, you know, that's not a fair question to ask what your favorite fly is, because of course it's kind of like, which fly would you use? I mean, it depends on the time of year and what you're fishing for.
All the flies in my shop, I've got 9 in there now, are all flies I use on a very regular basis. They work almost all the time in all conditions. So, I mean, you know, we talk about this a lot in the community for fly fishing world, is fly choice can be important. I mean, certainly fish might choose one fly over another, but presentation is usually king. If you can present it well, I mean, whether it be a dry fly, a nymph, whatever, a streamer, that's going to be the most important ingredient to a successful fishing day.
I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to any of my episodes, but I did an episode last year with Tom Stewart where we were fishing, and the first day he was sort of showing me the Euro nymphing tight lining, and he was using the sexy waltz worm, and pink, it had pink on it, a pink collar, so very similar to the ones that you're tying. I think he was using a tungsten bead, but I don't remember the color the bead. So anyways, I do want to try some of your sexy waltzes there. But he just cleaned up on me. So you were talking about technique versus flies. And I mean, I think he had me, I forget. It was his personal best day.
I think I heard that
day.
Episode. It was, I think he got 22 and you had a few.
22-3, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was just sticking to my elk hair caddis, or actually it's a deer hair caddis that I tie. And so then the next day I swapped over and just sort of adopted his technique and again with that sexy waltz and then I managed to outfish him by a little bit. So you're right about the technique. It's pretty drastic, hey?
Yeah. It depends on what your goals are though. I mean, if you want to target that fish that's rising over in a certain lane on that river and you want to get him on a dry and you want to figure out which dry he's going to eat, that's fun for you guy. By all means. I mean, or if you want to catch a large numbers day, that's a fun game to play too.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that about fly fishing. And I tend to lean more towards, I want to catch a fish. That is typically the way I approach it. If I can spend a day or an afternoon on a stream and catch a fish, the process, I talk a lot about process on my show. And when I'm doing the From the Wild episodes with Kevin, process is more important to me than anything, certainly more important than results. I'm glad you said that because you're bang on with that. Describe NorCal fishing for me a little bit, because you know the flies that you're using are similar to up here in the north, but I want to learn a little bit about fishing in that general area. So right now at this time of year, what are we are you know almost mid-May. What are you fishing right now? Even species, what species are you going for? And then, what is the general sort of, you're going to go out fishing tonight. How are you going to approach that?
Ooh, well, that's going to depend on where I'm going. I live right next to the Lower Sacramento River, which is our largest river in the state. It's probably similar to Alberta's Bow River in terms of size. And if I wanted to fish that in the evening, I mean, we have this crazy caddis hatch every evening in the warmer months. A lot of people don't realize also it's very hot here. It's usually one day a year where we're the hottest place on earth. So most people think of the Mojave or Arizona as being hot. It's also very hot in the Redding area, which is most people don't realize. So
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's usually over 100 degrees every summer day, often up into the 110s, but in Fahrenheit. Well, tonight, I mean, there's always going to be a consistent hatch and the fish are rising in that big river. So I would probably fish some kind of a caddis pattern, an elk hair or an X caddis to target them. But most rivers are, they're tailwaters. So there's a lot of reservoirs in California and most of our streams are below them or influenced by them directly. So, and they're often steep gradients. So they're rough, they're deep, a lot of rock, pocket water. Yeah. It's where I'm not totally familiar with your area. The closest I've been is the northern panhandle of Idaho, and it was very low gradient. slower water, a lot of riffly water.
We get both. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever fished the Bow or if you've seen it, but it's slow, meandering, wide, can be deep. And then we have rivers and streams that I see you fishing, which are the high gradient, you know, rocky, you know, scrambling down the side to get to the next pool. And then we have, you know, prairie streams that are just cut through a meadow with big, you know, browns in the undercut banks. So, yeah, we have a really good cross section.
Yeah, we don't.
But again, I mean, I'm sure you do, too. I mean, you're talking about just fishing your area, and I'm talking about fishing maybe up to 3 or 4 hours away, right? So
yeah, I mean, I could definitely find those kinds of streams as well, going that far away. But traditionally, though, they're very steep, rugged canyons. There's not a whole lot of spring creeks. There's not a lot of, you know, slow meandering meadows. There are a few, but they're not as common here. And you know, we call them coastal rainbows, is what the native species is. Most everything is rainbows. There are browns in some streams, but they're very infrequent. It's, I mean, there's cutthroats are hard to find, brook trout are in like some of the alpine lakes, but we don't, I mean, none of that's native.
No, those are stocked here as well. We have the same situation. So those, what did you call them? What are they? Coastal
they're called coastal rainbows is their technical name, and most people just call them rainbows.
Right. Yeah. Now, do those, are they sea run? Like, do they get out into the ocean?
Well, if they have access to them. I mean, we would call those steelhead, even though they don't necessarily look chrome. But our rivers are so long that they will get much of their color back before they're back in the systems.
So some of the fish that are in those higher reaches are never going to see the ocean, and then other ones that are down a little lower can swing up and down.
Yep, oh, and genetically, they're supposed to be the same. Mm-hmm. I've heard stories of rainbows. I think it's in Washington. It's the Elwha River. They had a dam removal and all the fish there became steelhead. Mm. They all went to the ocean, came back and spawned. So it was that was all still in their DNA.
Isn't that
even
funny?
Even though they'd never been to the ocean before.
That genetic memory, hey? That's crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
See, we don't have that in Alberta just simply because we don't have access to an ocean. You'd have to get over the divide.
Right.
So.
Yeah, you might have lake run rainbows or browns, right?
Most of our water, so yes to that, most of our water comes from glacial melt or high country melt. We do have, you know, I can think of one prominent spring fed stream, but most of it is very dependent on snowpack in the mountains in the high country. So it was interesting to hear you talk about how hot you get. It was also interesting to hear you talk about most of your rivers are tailwaters. So when you get these hot days in the summer, your fishing then, does that shut down?
It can. We're always preaching to carry a thermometer because when the water hits, 67, 68 degrees Fahrenheit, that's where mortality rate changes dramatically. So we keep an eye on it. And it depends. I mean, tailwaters are generally going to stay colder because they're flowing out of the bottom of a lake.
Yeah, that's what I was asking about.
As it goes further from that lake, though, it can warm up for sure. I mean, I've got some streams near my home that 100% in August. I mean, it'd be unwise to fish. And when it gets warm, the fish don't really want to eat either. Mm-hmm. So even though they might, it's not a good idea to.
So that's interesting. It still gives you options then, because unless I'm wrong, you just hike up a little higher and get closer to that water source, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're pretty lucky that a lot of the rivers stay cold. Many don't, though. And so you just got to be wise about that. And once you start carrying that thermometer and take temperatures, which I always make a point to do on camera, just if anything, just for a little bit of data to see how the bite relates. If it's super cold water too, that might, you know, turn the bite off also. But that just having that experience of thinking about the temperature is just a good habit for anglers, I think.
Mm-hmm. For the first time this year, Eric, I'm offering a fly fishing course. It's Fly Fishing 101. It's just a very, you know, because my skill set, I've been fishing for, how long? Well, 30 years, I guess, I've been fly fishing, but I'm not very good at it, I would say. I, you know,
well, there's always something to learn.
Exactly. And I don't pretend to, there's people out there that still just blow my mind with their knowledge of this activity in every imaginable way. And in some ways it makes it fun for me because I realize I still have so much to learn. But anyways, I'm offering this course just to get people introduced to the sport, just very basic, you know, definitions of things and explaining, you know, the process and whatnot.
Once people find out I had an audio video background, they're like, oh, that makes sense why the production quality is high. But, you know, I saw the trailer for your show, or, well, it's Kevin is his name, the creator of the show.
From the Wild?
Yeah.
That's Kevin's show. I'm just the on-screen talent. Yeah.
Gotcha. I mean, just that little trailer of you, I think it was tending to a whitetail you'd shot, or it was just cinematically so beautiful.
Yeah.
I envy, sometimes I wish I could have a standalone videographer to get those kinds of shots, because I have to compromise a lot with just locking it down on a tripod.
Well, you know, it's nepotism, but I should introduce you to my son Gareth, because he just graduated. Like, he's home for like 3 days now. He just graduated university, and he is wanting to start his videography business. So you should
one day
get him to volunteer some of his time and come down and hold the camera for you on some of your trips. Fun. I'm sure he'd be into that. But anyways.
That'd be awesome. Well, maybe I can come up there. And
oh, gosh. Yeah.
That'd be fun, too.
Yeah. Do you do a lot of traveling? Let's talk about that. Do you get away from the house lots, or now with your business, are you kind of stuck at home? Or did you ever travel for fishing?
I didn't really. I mean, I've traveled a few times. I mean, my brother and I took a trip down to the Sierras, which for us, that's a bit of a drive. And we, you know, spent a week down there, and I've gone north to Idaho a couple times for some other reasons and fit in some fishing on the rivers up there. And that was a pretty cool experience because those rivers are very different than anything we've got here. And of course, catching wild native West Slope cutthroat, or it's pretty special too, at least to me, because it's a new species that we don't have. And, I'd like to, I need to. I mean, I've built a network of people in YouTube that make fishing videos, and, you know, like Bob from Trout Flies in Utah, or I introduced you to, his name's Rosen, he lives in BC now, in Vancouver, formerly from Calgary. I'd love to go and fish up there with him someday too, but, you know, just, I don't know, there's just so many places to go. I haven't fully explored my home yet, so.
I know. Well, we talk about that all the time too. Actually, I'm kind of bummed out because right now, today is Wednesday. Yeah, this would have been my last day fly fishing in the Yukon with my buddy. I was supposed to get up there fly fishing for grayling, and then he got in a snowmobile accident, you know, 2 days before I left, and wrecked his collarbone really bad.
Oh, no.
Concussion. He's okay, but that was
You can't cast with a broken collarbone.
No, and he was hosting me. He lives up in Whitehorse, Yukon. And so he had a big sort of expedition plan for us that was, you know, required boat travel. And it's too bad that it didn't work out, but clearly it wasn't going to work out. But we said the same thing. We have so many waters to explore around here. The other thing we do too, I heard you mention that you do some fish or some lake fishing. That's one thing we have up here is a lot of ponds or lakes or whatever you want to call them that contain northern pike. So we have that's not something I haven't really explored down here much. But I was a guide in the Northwest Territories for a few years, and that was my favorite day when guests wanted to go fly fishing for pike, because up in the eastern arm of Great Slave Lake, we'd find them, and they look like submerged logs.
Yeah, they're huge.
They're like 4 feet long.
I'm
probably exaggerating a little bit, but they
they can get big.
Yeah, they can get up. You know, we were catching 25, 30 pounds, you know. On a fly rod. And even when we were we would fish the Stark River, which was a grayling stream, beautiful little stream, but it was only a mile and a half long that connected Stark Lake to Great Slave Lake, and lots of pockets that were fishable. But then in the headwaters, it was sort of a shallow bay of the lake, and you would anchor up in that current and then swing, you know, big streamers down. I guess similar to, I don't know what that would be like, but anyways, it was.
Yeah, we swing streamers down here for steelhead and
okay,
or there trout. You go. Sure.
Yeah, and we're hooking up with these lake trout, you know, and a 10-pound lake trout in a current, you know, that gives you all you can handle for a while.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I haven't really gone into the big fish game yet. I mean, I've caught a few fish over 20 inches, and I've gone steelheading in one of our rivers a few times this winter for the first time. And my biggest fish is a 25-inch. It was probably around five pounds. I mean, it was a big trout for sure. Yeah. But I don't have really heavy rods yet, so I haven't really tried to get to the coastal stuff where things can get up in the 15-pound range. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's exciting, or even to target salmon. We have a pretty healthy salmon population, but nobody really targets them on fly rods here. I'm not sure why.
Not many people up here as well. When we do this, I'm headed to Vancouver Island in June to actually do some bow hunting. And we're going to do some fly fishing, my son and I, on the way back. And one of the places we are going to go is to Tofino, where I ran into a guy who runs an outfitting company there. And he doesn't specialize because nobody wants to do it. But he himself is a fly caster. And he goes offshore and hits the kelp beds for different species. And so I'm kind of interested in that. Kind of interested is an understatement.
I would love to do some saltwater fishing too.
We were down, I was down, just, this is so cheesy, but I was down in Puerto Vallarta a few years ago and we went, I just hired a local guide in a boat to take me out. And we were hitting the Jack Crevels, the pods as they were, you know, it was mahi-mahi and Jack Crevels that were hammering these pods of what would they be? Some kind of bait fish, you know, herring, I guess it was. And that was a lot of fun too.
I bet. But cool.
I don't know. I'm with you though. You know, there's so much to do at home here. It's kind of hard to want to travel, right? But I don't know. I still get that itch.
I'm at an interesting crossroads. I try to fish with as many people. I've made a lot of friends through the channel and a lot of people, you know, like, hey, if you're over the area, let's go fishing together. And I usually say yes, and I'm kind of getting to the point where I have to start scaling that back because, you know, I kind of need to be strategic these days, at least with making content. It's not just willy-nilly, I need to go fishing, let's make a video. I'm trying to be a little more, you know, do some more pre-production and figure out what I need, what kinds of content to make or target certain things. And I don't know, I feel bad that I'm going to have to, I'm sort of crossing into that line of I can't say yes to everybody anymore.
No, I hear you. I do the same thing because with my show here, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I do these sort of interview episodes, which I just broadcast to everybody. But then I do the premium episodes, which are, you know, maybe not, they're a little longer in duration. This one's going on 45 minutes now, but I will do maybe an hour and they're sort of in situ, you know, right up your alley, I guess, as far as filmmaking, except I'm just capturing it, the audio, right? Okay. So we do like a documentary style, expedition style podcast episode. So I run those like 12 times a year, once a month, I guess, right? Very cool. Exactly what you were saying, you're just trying to, you got to plan out your calendar year, right? So no, you're right. You have to be a little picky with what you say yes to for sure. But you're right about that. It is hard. Well, speaking of which, we've hit that magic 45-minute mark. It was so wonderful to talk to you, Eric. I want to thank you again for being nice to me on Twitter, and it's led to a new friend, I feel. I cheer for you and your business, and just maybe remind people again where they can go to find some of your content.
Well, the biggest place would be YouTube. You can find my videos at youtube.com/EricLeslie. Or you can just search for me. And then the shop's at driftstone.co. You can see all my flies and the materials I've got. And you can find the rest of the social media from there.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be placing an order here with you sometime this summer. I might just wait now until after my trip because the trip seems to be expanding in scope, which means that my bank account is shrinking. But yeah, I want to grab some of your flies before I head out, at least anyway. So
cool. Thanks
so much for being here, Eric. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.